Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm David Santo, a humble human podcaster sitting in awe of the gifts and talents of the fungal world, as well as their seeming capacity to communicate and travel without keyboards or cars or even opposable thumbs. Mushrooms are the magical focus of today's episode, and though we're just going to touch the tip of their mycelial majesty, I do hope you'll be inspired to consider their omnipresent obscurity with new curiosity and care. First, though, listen to this. That was the sound not of silence, but of things happening both slowly and quickly, of decomposition, of digestion and recycling, and of networks so vast we barely perceive them. It was how I imagine mushrooms whispering to each other across their underground channels of mycelia, the thread-like structures that are birthed from fungal spores and that, under the right conditions, give rise to the fruiting bodies we know as mushrooms. Some mycelia are too small to see with the naked eye, whereas others, such as those of the Armillaria genus, can stretch across multiple square kilometers. Mushrooms are, literally and figuratively, wild. Most of us know mushrooms as an ingredient in pasta sauces, or in a risotto, or on a pizza. We stuff them and bake them and sauté them and turn them into pâté. And plenty of folks adore them, but just as many really don't. As one of my guests today says, though, those who don't like mushrooms probably just don't really know them. Like many parts of the food world, what we don't know about mushrooms is vast, and it probably exceeds what we do know. As part of the universe of microbial species, fungi and their effects, their behaviors, and their potential largely remain invisible to humans. We eat many of them, but lots of them we don't, because they're not so good for us. Some of us ingest certain types for their psychoactive properties and find that through consuming them, we can engage in a process or sense a connection to unfamiliar spaces or ideas, emotions, or even sources of creativity. In this way, as in the ways that fungi in nature serve to break down organic matter so that it can be repurposed as fodder for new growth, mushrooms can be understood as bridges between species and ecologies and between spaces and maybe even between time and other times. They close the loop in some ways between life and death, and they translate matter and energy from one place and space and time to the next. My interpretation of the sounds of mushrooms may be quite quiet, but in reality, they actually make a lot of noise. My guests for this episode both trade in mushrooms professionally, but they do so for reasons that go beyond taste and tradition and profit. As you'll hear, their fungal interests connect to what I've just mentioned, and also suggest that we listen and look more closely at things, the little things that are all around us. One of my guests is a gastronome living many lives in Mexico. The other is a biologist and shop owner here in Montreal who connects with people by connecting with mushrooms. Both will, I think, make you want to look at and think about mushrooms anew. Then during Stick This In Your Mouth, Maxime and I taste a couple of unusual fungal flavors, and we wrap things up with a food artist's response to the food questionnaire. My first conversation is with Nanai Watabe, a Japanese-Mexican mushroom enthusiast who spreads fungi to culinarily like-minded people in Mexico City. She's lived in Canada, Japan, and Mexico, as well as in Italy, where she did her master's degree at the University of Gastronomic Sciences. She's been involved in many different food-related projects to date, from managing a ranch to owning a sushi burrito stand. Nanai loves, distributes, and educates people on everything about wild mushrooms. So Nanai, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Welcome to Making a Meal of It. I'm so excited to be talking to you again. It's been a long time that we've known each other since those days back in Italy. But the first question I want to ask you, because you're doing so many different things, you've been doing so many things since we last met, and they're all in this fabulous world of food innovation that I think of you as occupying. Can you just tell me what you're doing these days and what you're up to?
So yeah, I am into mushrooms. I have been working with wild mushrooms for about 10 years now. And I basically started distributing wild mushrooms to restaurants. We're in Mexico City. And every year, you know, my clientele changes, but it's pretty much like amazing chefs, amazing people.
So was there a big demand for wild mushrooms in Mexico City restaurants before you came along? Or are you part of sort of creating a new market?
I think I'm part of that. It's always like nervous-wracking to say that. But definitely back when I started, it was only sort of the chefs that were interested in mushrooms. Mm-hmm.
I don't think of mushrooms as being particularly central to Mexican cuisine or the many Mexican cuisines that there are. Like huitlacoche, yeah, but that's not exactly mushroom in the way that we usually think of them. But are mushrooms central to a lot of Mexican cuisines?
Well, yeah, they are. And they're part of what I call like our cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. I mean, a third of the country is made up of forests.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Pine forests.
Yeah. So it's great territory for mushrooming.
Great territory. And I mean, just to sort of name a few, but we have chanterelles, we have morels, we have porcini, we have coral mushrooms, we have even matsutake.
Oh, wow.
You know? So whether they are cooked at restaurants in like non-Mexican recipes, but they are part of our sort of our culture and the way the industry works. Like they're part of the industry, you know? For me, wild mushrooms are cooked best in Mexican recipes in Oaxaca City.
Yeah, okay.
In Oaxaca State, which has the most variety of mushrooms in the whole country.
Okay. So the their presence has made them more familiar, at least to restaurant cooks. I will admit, I have a very limited perspective on Mexican cuisine, so I feel a bit stupid even asking the question, but thank you for letting us know.
No, but you know, it's a very important question because that's part of the reason I started working with them. I saw sort of so many factors involved in just this one little being, you know, and implied for me environmental sustainability involved with mushrooms. For one, so you go to the forest, you have to take care of the forest, no? There's this sociocultural sustainability, no? You have to talk to the communities. They're the pickers. They're the ones doing the hard work and going to the forest with their families. So there, I call them my maestras or maestros.
So your teachers.
Yeah. And it turns out that they're mostly women. Mm-hmm. They bring their families and it's like sort of passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And there's this economical sort of sustainability that is involved in all of this. So when I first saw it, I was like, this is the way that I want to learn more about Mexico, and mushrooms are important. But Mexicans don't know that they come from Mexico and Mexican forests and an hour away from the city. And that just blew my mind, no? Como, how can we not know about our cultural heritage?
Right. Well, because there's so many iconic foods of Mexico and so many iconic ingredients that the humble mushroom can be ignored, even though it's absolutely there and absolutely being eaten.
Sometimes we appreciate the foreign things more than we do our local ingredients.
Yeah.
So if it comes from the States or France or, I don't know, Europe, oh my God, wow, it's imported, whatever. And no, we're back to appreciating our own culture more than ever.
So you've been learning about mushrooms yourself from your maestras and your maestros, but you've also been teaching. You've also been teaching the restaurant community to a certain extent what delicious things are available and that you can forage in a sustainable way close to home.
Correct. So what I saw is that, you know, distributing them was a great way to know chefs, no, for one part. But then one chef approached me. He was the sous chef of Puyol back in the day. His name is Fabio, great guy. And he decided that he wanted to connect his kitchen. He even brought the dishwasher. He wanted to have them reconnect with their food and know exactly what they're dealing with. He wanted to take them up to the forest mushroom hunting. And so that was sort of my first group. And so I then noticed that there was this incredible need for one, people in the kitchen, which seems obvious, to connect to reconnect with their food mm-hmm. and know where it comes mm-hmm. from. So we went up there and it was one of the most incredible sort of experiences ever. It was a great way to make my very small business kind of complete and holistic mm-hmm. in the way mm-hmm. that there's sort of the commercial distribution side of it, but then there's also the educational side of it, no?
Right. So you're talking about the people from the regions where you're mushrooming. You're talking about the people who are cooking the mushrooms. You're talking about the mushrooms and the forest. You're talking about Mexico and its cultural heritage. This is like a whole huge network of relationships that you are helping to facilitate. You're a relationship builder.
See, and I kind of relate to mushrooms in a way that I feel like I'm also this like, I'm kind of like a mycelium. A relationship builder and connector, and we communicate. And I call myself like this bridge, no?
Yeah.
Where I kind of translate sort of mushroom world to a sort of commercial world too. I mean, there's so many things to translate. For one, I mean, these communities will, you know, not invoice, not give credits. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. and so I'm being that bridge, no? Like, I'm slowly writing down sort of in my invoice. You know, it's not porcini, it's called pambazo in the local community where I go, no?
So it's also teaching about the other names that these foods go by that are not the Italian name or the French name or the English name.
Correct, correct. No, I'm this middle woman and mushroom dealer, no? That will pay the pickers, no? In cash up front. And then I will sort of go to the restaurant and call it a pambazo, no? In a way to sort of educate a little about how Mexicans call right. their mushrooms.
So that the existing knowledge is there and we don't need to call it porcini, like an Italian word to describe a Mexican mushroom. No, we can call it by our own word.
Exactly. And sort of also place Mexico in this position that it deserves, mm-hmm. no? I call it in Spanish como enaltecer, you know, making it tall and putting it in its right place. Yeah. And that's calling it by its local name, no? And that translation is important, no? And that my position is important in order for them to be able to communicate, no? And they communicate through me. The communities charge way too little money. And whatever price they are giving me, I'm paying. So whatever my client is willing to pay is what it is. I buy and resell, but it's based on respecting the prices of the pickers.
So you're not trying to get the pickers to raise their prices so that they've got more money in their pockets. You're just respecting what they think their work and their product is worth.
Yeah, exactly. Plus paying upfront for a mixture of mushrooms for one price.
So you're also simplifying it for everybody to a certain extent.
Right, because, for example, there's no grading in mushrooms in Mexico. There's no, like, small mushroom for a much higher price. It's one price for a kilo of mixed sizes. There's this idea that the smaller mushroom is worth more money because, you know, it's prettier, it has less worms, and at the end of the day, you're dealing with nature.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and the way that the pickers work is different, no? They pick everything. So for me, it's important to respect that and not sort of, well, I'll take all of your best mushrooms, no? And then pay the same price. No, I mean, eventually, if there were some grading system that I might try and do, we'll see how it works. Okay. And this has also educated the restaurants and the chefs, kind of like respecting that. So that's my little sort of way of saying, one, this is how nature works. You're going to get some with tons of worms. There's no like one small mushroom, one small pambazo, aka porcini.
Yeah.
And also have a lot of worms. So when I deliver to a restaurant, I have rules. You cannot return any of your product. This is how nature works. It's already a cheap price, even with me adding my percentage, which doesn't make me rich. And this is how the economy of the mushroom works. Mm-hmm. You have to adapt to the mushroom. The mushroom will not adapt to you. And you have to adapt to a market.
So this is what you're describing is what a lot of people that I've met who do mushrooms describe, is that they have to come into the rhythm of the mushroom itself. You can't force a mushroom to grow. You can't force a mushroom to be available when you want it. You are very much in relationship with nature and learning about where they might be, where they were before, where they might come again. You have to pay attention to the climate. It's really about that relationship with nature. And you have to develop that relationship. You have to understand the relationship in order to become someone who can have access to the mushrooms. Because if you don't have the knowledge, if you don't have the sensibilities, you don't have the relationship, you're never going to find the mushrooms.
You order on Monday, no? You give me your ideal sort of order. And then on Tuesday, I will let you know what comes through.
Yeah.
Trust me, if I don't have any mushrooms, I don't have any mushrooms. They didn't come out. And we're going through this period of huge, intense climate change.
Yeah.
And every year is different.
Yeah, of course. This is a very non-conventional model when it comes to supplying restaurants with foods who expect consistency, regularity, deals, a commodity relationship, not a nature relationship. How are the chefs reacting to it?
It's been great, actually. It's a matter of also communicating that, mm-hmm. No, and really explaining it. And they're like, perfect, okay, that's too bad, and we'll see you next week. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we get mushrooms. I did have to go through some complicated, you know, relationships where, for example, one of them was like, I need you to be here at 10, and I need you to bring me yay-sized mushrooms, and you need to bring me 100 pieces every day.
And you said,
well, good luck. Even if I charged you like three times as much, that doesn't work with mushrooms.
Right.
So I say it's been great because I had to go through that whole educating process, no? And I had to be very thorough with the rules, and it just takes time.
You've done a lot of stuff since we knew each other in Italy when you were studying at the University of Gastronomic Sciences. When I saw you last in person, it was, I think, 2016 in Mexico City, and you were running a sushi burrito kiosk. And that's not something you're doing anymore, but you've had this incredible dedication to food and all the projects you've done. You're really an innovator. You're a thinker. You're a combiner. Where do all those questions and curiosities come from, including your interest in mushrooms?
Wow.
Big question. Why are you?
Existential question. I think it really falls back onto my parents, no? My grandparents. So I have two sides to me. I have my Mexican side from my mom, and I have my Japanese side from my dad. I used to say that I'm 50-50, and then a friend in Japan, when I lived there when I was in middle school, was like, you're not 50-50, you're 100-100.
Nice.
So it's from my childhood.
Yeah.
And the way in which those cultures were really mixed in Mexico City, where I grew up, and I was born and raised here. And my mom always, for example, in a meal at home, we would always have like white rice, no, for my dad. But then he spent like, I don't know, like 30 years in Mexico, but he also wanted his pico de gallo, mm-hmm. you know, and that combination of flavors and cultures in one meal, in three meals per day, no?
That sounds like heaven. Japanese and Mexico in the same plate. Wow.
I'm not going to lie. I think it was the most enjoyable and the best way to really get into food. I think both cultures really appreciate sitting down and having a dinner, or la comida in Mexico, no? A lunch, mm-hmm. as a family. And the food that you eat is, you know, good quality and based on tradition. And I didn't know it until, I guess, now, how much that really changed or guided me, no, to where I am now.
Well, let us all be 100-100. I love that as an idea.
Isn't
why,
that
divide,
nice?
Why divide ourselves? Be fully everything. So then the mushrooms, when did the mushrooms become an interest?
I was directing a ranch in the state of Mexico. It was owned by a family, and it was a horse ranch, and they, you know, specialized on dressage. But one of the sons, his mother got cancer, and he wanted to build this like holistic center. And so he hired me, and we did this whole plan based on permaculture techniques. So then working there and just being at this beautiful ranch surrounded by this beautiful forest, One of the workers actually came in one morning with a bucket full of things I had never seen before. And I asked him, and he was like, it's obvious it's mushrooms. And I was like, oh, okay. Where did you get them from? And he said, like, right up here, up the hill.
Wow.
I asked him, can you take me in? And, you know, he kind of ignored me, and it took me like a month to convince him.
No, this is my mushroom patch. I'm not going to show it to you.
You know how mushroom people are. Mm-hmm. But in Mexico, it's a little different, though. I think they like to share. But yeah, so ever since that first day he took me up there, I'm still here. Like, so you know how we talked about that, those different sustainabilities?
Yeah.
And I recently added a new one, which is like an emotional sustainability. Because when you're up there in the forest, you go through a ton of emotions. People go through frustration, excitement. I mean, like finding your first mushroom, I mean, your brain clicks. I mean, I've read it, no? That literally your brain does do a little click and it now knows what to look for, no? That click is magical and spiritual. And then I always say that you don't find the mushroom finds you. You know?
Wow. So you're transforming human beings and you're also bridging from the, as you call it, the fungal world, translating the fungal world into the human world. So one of the ways you're translating it, you told me, is that you're also writing a book about mushrooms. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. So this year I got a book deal. It's not necessarily, for example, like a recipe cookbook. There will be recipes from some of like the most amazing people and chefs here in Mexico City and in Oaxaca and Puebla. It's not an identification guide either. It's more the story behind mushrooms, the forest, and the people.
So it's the relationships again.
Exactly. So I call it sort of the sociocultural story of mushrooms.
And when might the book be available in distribution locations?
Next year, hopefully. And we're planning on it being available in Spanish for the moment, before the mushroom season starts, which in Mexico is the summer.
Well, I wish you all the best with it. So what, so is this your whole life right now, mushrooming, dealing in mushrooms, trading mushrooms, and then also writing about them? Or do you have other projects going on?
No, I mean, this is sort of the main passion, no? And I'm so happy because I feel like I'm very fortunate to being able to do what I'm passionate about. And I don't think I've ever stuck to anything for this long either.
Well, then I thank you so much for chatting to me about mushrooms and sharing all of your incredible perceptions and stories and imaginaries about what you're building there in Mexico. I'm very, very glad that you were there and very glad that I will be seeing you again soon, I hope. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much.
And for more about Nanay and Estado de Hongos, her book on the remarkable world of Mexican mushrooms and beyond, take a look at her Instagram account at Nana Watabe, that's NanaWatabe. There's also a link in the show notes. Coming up next is my chat with Judith Noël Gagnon, co-owner and manager of La Mico Boutique in Montreal, a shop dedicated to all things mushroomy. In operation since 2006, their aim is to provide customers with all the good things that mushrooms can contribute to our lives, from diet to health, hobbies to knowledge. So Judith, tell me about this amazing place we're sitting in, La Mico Boutique, the mushroom store. How long have you been around and how was it created?
So it's been 18 years in Plateau Mont-Royal in Montreal. My dad had this crazy idea of opening a mushroom only dedicated to mushrooms.
Fantastic.
And because I'm a biologist, I started to work with him. Because I'm a biologist, but also because I wanted to work with him.
Mm-hmm. So, and so the store started 18 years ago and has been running this whole time.
Exactly.
Throughout COVID, throughout everything, it's the speaks to the power of mushrooms.
So yeah, it's really a teamwork and a family business. So sometimes when it's so difficult, you know, we do things that other business won't do.
Yeah. So, and you've been here for how long now in the shop?
In the shop, 17 years. So my dad opened that in 2006. I was working at the biodome as a biologist, and I decided to come here and help them working.
So you've been part of the story almost since the beginning. Exactly. And it's lovely that you have this kind of mushroom-focused philosophy on running a business. That is, it's organic. It has to come and go with the seasons and the times and the moments, and you adapt.
Exactly. So at first, we had one shelf with few mushrooms, and people were asking for that type of mushroom. We tried to find it, and then other type of product, we found it, and people were interested in fermentation. We added this subject to our product, so now we're selling books on fermentation. Mm-hmm. People were interested in growing mushroom. We started a lab where we were able to produce mycelium and sell mycelium so people can cultivate that.
Yeah. So you're very responsive. You're like, again, it's a very mushroom-focused philosophy. That's fabulous. What is it? I mean, what is it about mushrooms that you, but that people seem to find so fascinating?
Well, it's invisible, but it does so many things in our environment. It's good for the forest. It's good for the food, your health, and it's pretty. It's so pretty. Yeah. A mushroom is incredibly pretty when it grows. It grows so fast also. It's like in a minute to change the form. So it's kind of something out of space.
Yeah. And they do seem to occupy this kind of, well, of course, there's magic mushrooms. That's one side of the mushroom world. But there's also just this, as you say, this idea that they aren't there one day, and then the next day, suddenly, the mushroom has appeared. And it is almost like magic, even if they're not hallucinogenic. So are the people who come here just looking for cool mushrooms? Are they looking for a community? Are they as focused on the sort of their responsive and cultural and philosophical parts of mushrooms as you are? Or are they more looking for good taste?
It's really a lot of people. It's many interests. Some people just want to add some umami to their plate. They want to make a good risotto. Other will like to join us in our mushroom excursion so they can learn, they can get out of the city, they can have a fun time with their friends, family. Other want to learn how to grow. They want to grow their mushroom in their small garden. So it's very diverse.
Have you ever been asked for something rather odd by one of your customers?
I did. I was thinking about that last night. This week, someone asked me for mushroom to get rid of the vaccine in his blood. So this, I don't have.
That's taking the magic of mushrooms to a whole other kind of level.
Is there a mushroom that could get rid of the vaccine in my blood? I was like, that's not in my...
Wow.
No, I could not do that. But of course, people are looking for mushroom for their health. Sometimes they have cancer and... they're looking for a cure.
Mm-hmm. But there is this kind of, again, it comes back to that mystique of the mushroom as being something, some species beyond the normal when it comes to food.
Yeah, it's something that we didn't know. 100 years ago, we started to learn on bacteria, and we're starting to learn on viruses. And mushroom, we're just beginning to know what they could do. Mm-hmm. In Quebec, we have more than 3,000 mushrooms that we can see with your eyes.
Wow.
But other that you don't see that are just in the soil or sometimes on your skin or...
Yeah, of course. And funguses, fungi are all around us, and they're part of the microbiome, and they're part of this unseen world.
Exactly.
And that they have huge effects on our bodies and on our environments and the ways that we interact with... You know, that there's kind of a bridge between humans and nature in some way, because they exist on us, but they exist out there. So there's this kind of facilitator role that they play in creating connections between worlds.
Actually, yes, true. They share different characteristics with humans, with bacteria, with animals and plants too. And because of the symbiosis between plant and mushroom called mycorrhizal relationship, this is a bridge between earth and the trees. So yeah, it's incredible. What they do is unknown today. Mm-hmm.
And we just, as a biologist also, you are very aware of the fact that we don't know that much about mushrooms or fungi in the same way that we know somewhat better, as you mentioned, the world of bacteria and viruses and the yeasts also, and all the things that create fermentation. I think it's, you know, it's very appropriate. I think the store is selling
mushroom stuff and fermentation stuff and all of these small creature stuff that make food wonderful.
Exactly.
So here in the shop, you have an incredible array of different mushrooms themselves. We can hear the refrigerators in the background a little bit that are preserving the mushrooms. You've got the mushroom lab producing mycelium. You've got tons of books, all sorts of accessories, some transformed products, some products from Quebec, products from outside of Quebec. What are your favorite things in this shop? What are your favorite mushroom products?
Oh, it depends on the season. Mm-hmm. So many times I've been asked this question, what is your favorite mushroom? Well, it depends on the season because during chanterelle season, it's the chanterelle. Mm-hmm. During morel is morel. But what I prefer, I would say, is the excursion. The part where we bring people out of the city. We meet in a place at 9:30. We have 25 person with us, two guides, and we take a walk foraging mushroom, mm-hmm. take a break for lunch, and then a session where we identify the mushroom, and then a tasting session. So this, for me, is really a fun part of the shop. I mean, I have to wake up at 6 or maybe earlier to get on time for people. I have to find places, and sometimes it will rain, or sometimes it's just not so dry. There's no mushroom, but I always have this energy on that day to wake up and take my car and travel and meet those people. I like really excursion are really fun.
Well, it sounds fabulous. I think I did a mushroom excursion a few years ago, and it was that incredible sense of community and mm-hmm. connection and discovery. You're with people, but you're also with these magical creatures in the woods. And there's something, I don't know, I've never been a hunter. I've never been a forager very much, mm-hmm. but the discovery of a mushroom in the woods is a gorgeous thing. It's like a gift in some way.
It's like a treasure hunt.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, treasure hunt. Oh, I found this. Is it worth it? Is it good? Or does it stink? Or does it change color? Or how many could I find more? And I mean, it's always fun. And it's energizing too, because you're walking. It's like a meditation for me. You know? You're looking for something. You're just leaving all your bad things at home, your work. And you're just thinking of finding something, and you're into the moment.
Yeah, it really does make you remember to be present.
Exactly.
The mushrooms. So here in Montreal, we actually have some urban farms mm-hmm. producing mushrooms. And that seems like it's very practical at the commercial scale. They produce often on different substrates. It's not on soil, but in the basement of an industrial building, for example, you can have a mushroom farm. What do you think of that community of producers and what they're contributing to the overall market for mushrooms here?
Well, these people are fantastic. I know many of them. I know that there was 8 mushroom farm in Montreal. They're so dedicated to what they do. They are happy to nourish people, to feed people with good food, with good mushroom freshness. I mean, I'm so proud of that. But it's hard because Montreal market is really near Ontario. Mm. And in Ontario, there's big farmers.
Okay.
They are great too, but they produce a lot more than the Montrealers farmer. So sometimes prices go lower and it's hard to be competitive when you're on a smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
And also what I learned is that people at home, at the grocery, they don't eat that much mushroom. I would like people to eat more mushroom, maybe at least once a week.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, that will help farmers to stay sustainable. So, yeah, I'm happy for them, but people have to eat more mushrooms so they can still grow and do their beautiful things.
So support your local mushroom grower.
Exactly.
My partner, Maxime, likes mushrooms now, but he grew up as a kid really mm-hmm. disliking the taste, the texture, everything about mushrooms. And I think mushrooms are very divisive for some people. Some people love them, some people hate them. Do you get a sense of why that might be? What is it about the taste or the texture of mushrooms that some people absolutely love and some people really don't like?
Well, I will say that people that don't like mushrooms don't know mushrooms. Mm-hmm. Probably it's just a question of education, you know. When you eat a vegetable, maybe you don't like zucchini, but you like tomatoes and peppers. And so mushrooms are very diverse. You don't have the same taste in a chanterelle than in a morel. It's not the same texture. It doesn't cook equally. You have to cook them differently. So people that don't like mushroom probably just experience the white button mushroom. Mm-hmm. And maybe they ate a mushroom on a pizza that were from a jar, you know.
Yeah.
So the texture is more mushy. So I think it's just a question of trying, opening your mind, trying new things, and maybe cooking them differently.
Yeah. And do you think you've made converts here at the shop to new kinds of mushrooms or to mushrooms in general?
My best friend, Adele, did not like mushroom, and now she loves them. So yeah, I'm so proud of that.
One of the things I love about the shop, just like we're sitting here, I can smell this incredible aroma. It seems to be everywhere and kind of permeating me. And I remember when I was in Seoul, in Korea once, and I was eating a lot of local mushrooms, and I started having this feeling that the mushrooms were in me and on me, and I was almost sweating mushrooms because I felt this presence of mm-hmm. mushrooms. It was very comforting for me, and actually felt really well in my body because I could just keep smelling this mushroomy aroma. Again, what is it about mushrooms that kind of transcends food and humans and the sort of separation of the inside and the outside? Do you think mushrooms hold the secrets to some sort of spiritual other way of being?
I don't know. Well, probably with magic mushroom, this will lead you to know something, new things about yourself and the environment. There are so many chemicals in mushroom that we don't know yet. You know, I was at a Zoom talk last week for CMM, Cercle des Mycologues de Montréal, where they were talking about toxic mushroom, for example. And there's new mushroom that we used to eat that are considered toxic today. So this is in movement. Other mushroom that were not considered edible that are now considered edible.
Oh, so the sort of standards of scientific measurement have changed,
exactly.
Or we understand the effects on our bodies differently.
Exactly. So some that were considered non-edible because too tough are considered edible now, but in a tisane where they are boiled and dripped,
right.
For example, shaga. But other polyporous that are soft were not considered edible. But now we know that they are edible and we eat them. Other mushrooms, on the other hand, were considered edible. And we know that now that if we eat a kilo of them, we can get sick because of the accumulation of certain type of toxin that we don't know very well yet. But we know that we have an adverse effect.
So the Cercle des Mycologues de Montréal, is that the Mycologists
Society
of Montreal?
Oh, Montreal, yeah. It's the biggest mycologist association in all North America.
And what is the objective of this association?
These are, bénévoles. Volunteers yeah. that bring people in the wood. They make excursion too. They make a conference too.
So it's an education
exactly.
organization. Yeah, to raise our consciousness and awareness around
mushrooms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for you and the Miko Butsiek after 16, 17, 18 years? Do you see things changing for yourselves? Or are you going to keep staying the course, continue being responsive to the community?
Yes, we want to adapt to the new market. I'm looking for a new place because I see mycelium or lab is being too small for what we could do. So probably I will open a new warehouse where I can make things bigger and start
rhizomatically expanding.
expanding my web to the whole Canada.
Good. Well, I will look forward to the fruiting bodies of your success in the future and the harvest. May the harvest be plentiful and delicious for you.
Thank you
so much for
being
here.
Thank you very much.
And check out the show notes for a link to the Miko Butsiek and their online shop, which includes art, books, supplies, food, and lots of fungal fun.
Maxime, I have some bad news for you.
Oh, what is it?
There's a fungus among us.
Oh, no!
Yeah. We're eating mushrooms.
Oh, yay.
This is the fungal edition of Stick This in Your Mouth.
Oh, my.
Are you excited?
I am.
Yeah.
Yes, I like mushrooms now.
Okay, but you didn't used to, did you?
No.
Tell me about your history with mushrooms.
Well, like everything, the 70s was, there was a lot of canned foods. And I think the first time I had a mushroom was a canned mushroom. And I, of course, did not appreciate the texture at all.
Was it like on a pizza or in a sauce?
I think it was in a sauce, and then it probably was on a pizza. I used to pick it out when we would order pizza, the very rare times we would order pizza in Saint-Georges-de-Beauce. I would pick them out. It was something about the texture once again. I, of course, thought that fresh mushroom was going to be the same experience. So I ran away from those. If there was mushroom in a sauce or in a dish, it was visible to my eye, I would put it aside and not eat it. So for the longest time, I didn't think I like mushroom.
Mm-hmm. But we eat mushrooms very happily together,
yes,
now, right?
We love it.
So what was the mycelial moment that brought you around?
December 2001, New York.
Well, you know exactly.
Yes, restaurant in the West Village, and I had a fungi salad, and I fell in love with mushrooms.
What kind of mushrooms were in there?
Boy, I only know them in French. So what is a pleurote?
A pleurote is an oyster mushroom.
And then there was like the portobello and then a couple of other varieties. And the dressing was amazing. And it was just like a nice, hearty. It was an Italian restaurant. And it was a nice, hearty dish. And it was so, so, so tasty. And not at all the texture I expected. And I was so happy.
Well, and as we know, mushrooms are not just one thing. There are zillions of different kinds of mushrooms. There are mushrooms that we eat and mushrooms that we don't eat, mushrooms that we see, mushrooms that we don't see. So to say that you don't like mushrooms is kind of damning an entire species after having eaten that one canned variety.
Exactly.
All right. So today we're going to try two sort of mushrooms, but within the fungal family. One is huitlacoche, which is called sometimes corn mushroom. It's very common in Mexico, and it's actually a fungal infection of ears of corn. So listeners, go look it up online and be horrified about what we're about to eat. It's visually not that attractive. And lots of grains get fungal infections. Ergot is an infection of, I think, rye, which has some of the same hallucinogenic properties as LSD. So that's ergot. That's not a thing that we like to have in our grains. But huitlacoche, which are these corn mushrooms, are very prized and very delicious and very interesting. So we've got some, unfortunately, we don't have fresh ones. We only have it in a jar.
So how they come in different forms?
Well, the mushrooms themselves grow, like they basically eat the corn. They digest the corn and grow themselves. So that's what the, you know, mushrooms are digesters, basically. So in the woods, when you see a mushroom on a tree branch, it's basically digesting that tree. And that's their incredibly important function in forests, because they help degenerate all the dead matter and turn it back into humus and then turn it back into living matter again. Mm-hmm. So mushrooms complete the cycle from life to death. They're very associated with the life and death cycle of other systems. So these ones I actually bought at the Mico Boutique here in Montreal, and they came in a jar and they were cooked. They're already cooked, and they've got a little bit of canola oil and salt in the jar too. So they've been cooked, and we're going to eat them on a piece of tortilla to have a little mild, not really authenticity, but whatever. So the time I had them, they were basically served as a taco ingredient.
Oh, okay.
But you can put them in sauces. I mean, I'm going to use the rest of the jar probably to make a mushroom sauce for a pasta at some point in the next couple of days.
Wow, wonderful.
So let's see what they go.
Let's dive in.
So what do you, I'll serve them up, but what are you seeing right now? Can you describe them?
Well, they're actually quite small and dark, almost black.
Yeah, it's kind of mushed up.
Yeah, and it's kind of mushed up, and it looks almost like a paste.
Yeah, it's small chunks, and if you actually look closely, you can see there are what looks like pieces of corn in there, and it is actually the corn that's been basically digested by the by the fungus.
Well, cheers.
Buen provecho.
It's strange because you taste corn immediately.
And you can see the little corn, not niblets anymore. They're much bigger than like sweet corn niblets, but they are still fairly much there. And you can actually, there's some of the corn silk is in this mix as well.
And it also reminds me of truffles and mm-hmm. the outside of truffles because of the darkness. I mean, mushrooms come in different colors and varieties, but this is, it's interesting.
Does it taste like mushroom to you?
I don't know if it's because of the corn tortilla, but like I taste a lot of corn.
Mm. Well, try it here. Just try it on a spoon.
Yeah. The corn taste is not as present. Texture-wise, it's a little bit like the usual mushroom, mm-hmm. which is the sponginess, but it's yummy. It's really good.
Yeah. They taste a bit like well-cooked regular button mushrooms to me, or crimini mushrooms.
Portobello for me.
Oh, a bit darker.
Yeah, darker.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, second item, also from the beautiful Miko Boutique here in Montreal, is something that I saw on the shelf when I was there talking to Judith. Not your favorite thing in the world, but I thought I would try it just because it's from Quebec. So we have huitlacoche from Mexico, and then we've got Appalachian truffle oil
mm-hmm.
from Quebec. So we're going to try this just on a spoonful. Judith recommended having it with a little bit of salt. So I'm going to put some on a spoon.
Okay.
And then just... salt. This is like not an olive oil tasting, but a truffle oil tasting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not truffles, but it tastes like truffles. It's reminiscent of a regular truffle oil I've had in the past.
Mm-hmm. Do you like it?
I'm not a big fan of truffle oil because what I've had in the past, I'm sure, was not made with real truffle, but was a fake truffle taste that was infused into the oil. It's just not a taste that appeals to me when it's fake, but this is actually quite interesting.
Do you like fresh truffles?
Love fresh truffles, but they're just like I've only had those a few times in my life, and I know how expensive they are. And
yeah, ridiculous. Like when I was in Italy, when it was white truffle season, it was madness, and people, some of my friends bought some truffles, small ones. But they go up to like 5,000 euros a kilo. It's just a ridiculous amount of money.
It's insane. Anyway,
not for us. So this truffle oil, there are truffles in Quebec. There are truffles called these Appalachian truffles.
Mm-hmm.
And
are they also found at the base of trees?
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. They're very tiny at this point. And there are actually some truffleries that have been seeded with the truffle spores. And so production has not actually come into its own yet, because often truffles take years and years and years to bloom, basically. But a few of them have been harvested, but they're tiny. They're pea-sized, apparently, at this point.
Oh, wow.
If you can find them. And so this product is actually synthesized truffle aroma in oil. But the aroma has been synthesized from the original truffle. So it's basically a molecular match to what is growing inside the truffle. But it's not actual truffles that have been crushed and then infused in oil.
I've had a recipe that I love, which I've lost a recipe of, where it was chopped liver cooked with a few spices. And you would put that on a crouton and then just put a little bit of truffle oil.
Oh, let's do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Liver and truffles.
Yes.
That's living. Well, Maxim, thanks very much for sticking some mushrooms in your mouth. I've always thought you were a really fun guy.
Yes.
Fun guy?
Oh, fun guy.
All right, we're close to the end of the season, so the dad jokes will be ending soon. But meantime, merci beaucoup.
Bon, merci, au revoir.
Bye.
Bye.
In this podcast and in other parts of my life, I always feel really humbled talking to food folks about their special areas of knowledge and practice. I consider myself to be fairly well-informed about my field, but there's always something more to know. And that open expanse of wisdom and experience only gets bigger the more I wander through it. So when it comes to mushrooms, I feel like my humility has to increase a lot. 1,000-fold, 1,000,000-fold. Talking to Nanai and Judith and witnessing their own amazement regarding a subject they themselves are so knowledgeable about, well, that just kind of floors me. So instead of sharing my own thoughts about mushrooms right now, I'm actually going to turn instead to those of Anat Singh, a writer and thinker and professor in the anthropology department at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She has written extensively about mushrooms through the lens of speculation, philosophy, and multi-species ethnography. Many folks in the food world turn to her for inspiration and understanding, largely when it comes to the ways in which people and other species interrelate, and how so much potential understanding of our world still resides in the cracks and crevices and shadows, often hidden by humanity's need to expand its economic and political reach, even as that reach more than frequently exceeds our grasp. In 2012, Anitsing published an article called Unruly Edges, Mushrooms as Companion Species, in which she details some of the ways in which humans often make a mess of things when it comes to our relationships with landscapes, with other species, and, of course, with ourselves. Mostly, though, she also shares the way that mushrooms, through their quiet omnipresence, also suggest other, more caring and attentive ways to relate. Her text is punctuated with lovely statements about other ways of looking at things, and she then expands on those statements to suggest, gently, how we can do and be better. I will therefore close this little reflection with Anitsing's own words, and not mine. Perhaps these snippets of what she says will inspire you to read the whole essay, which I've linked to in the show notes. Wandering and love of mushrooms engender each other. Walking is the speed of bodily pleasure and contemplation. It is also the speed to look for mushrooms. Mushrooms are well known as companions. The concept of symbiosis, mutually beneficial interspecies living, was invented for the lichen, an association of a fungus and an alga, or cyanobacteria. Human exceptionalism blinds us. Science has inherited stories about human mastery from the great monotheistic religions. These stories fuel assumptions about human autonomy, and they direct questions to the human nature of control on the one hand, or human impact on nature on the other, rather than to species interdependence. Fungi are indicator species for the human condition. Few fungi have found their way into human domestication schemes, and only a few of those, such as fungi used for industrial enzyme production, have had their genomes badly tampered with. Supermarket button mushrooms are the same Agaricus bisporus as those growing in meadows. Yet fungi are ubiquitous, and they follow all our human experiments and follies. Outside the house, between the forests and fields, bounty is not yet exhausted. Closing out this contemplative episode of Making a Meal of It are some food questionnaire responses from one very remarkable artist, food maker, and thinker. Annika Walsh is a master's student in integrated studies in land and food systems at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. A transdisciplinary artist who was born in Chuzhou, China, and adopted at 11 months of age by her family in Canada, Annika works with a wide variety of ingredients, materials, and collaborators to form her conceptual pieces. Her practice ranges from exploration of cultural identity to participatory food performances and everything in between. When we recorded her answers to the questionnaire, Annika described herself as passionate, frizzy, and a fusion. Annika, what is your idea of a perfect food?
I think my level of hunger affects this perception more than the actual qualities of the food. I think sometimes people think about the perfect food in terms of what the food is giving to them, but it's more my state that affects how attracted I am to a certain food. So if I'm really hungry, I tend to not be too picky about all the aspects that go into a food.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Reciprocity.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Extraction.
Which food person do you most admire?
I really admire my friends in Prince Edward County, Ontario, a lot. They are small-scale farmers and winemakers doing their thing with an immense amount of passion. It's super inspiring to work next to them when I'm there in the summer.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
I try to ignore plant-based imitation red meat. I think I used to be really interested in it, but it freaks me out now.
What do you consider an overrated food or food context?
Quote, fine dining food and branded food.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
I dislike the heads of tables. As a child, I used to always claim it before the oldest male did in the room.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
I really love a good fatty piece of meat. The velvety texture is just unmatched, and it's definitely something I really, really love.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Soy sauce, rice wine, and chili oil.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
Saucier skills. I totally would love to be more inclined to make sauces with my meals because I really like the presence of them in a dish, but I just don't have that instinct or comfort to make a good sauce.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
I have gotten to a really, really great place in my pork and chive dumpling recipe.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
My rice cooker.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Spam.
What is your favorite aroma?
Bone broth that has been simmering for hours in my home.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
I don't use a whisk that often, yet I have a typical sized one and a mini one.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
Chef Roy Choi, Matty Matheson, and Samin Nosrat.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
I identify with Americanized / Canadianized Chinese takeout cuisine.
What is your most powerful sense?
Touch sense. Textures are my favorite.
What would you eat as your second to last meal?
Dim sum.
So that's all for having fun with fungus. For now, anyway. May your mushrooms be fresh and feisty and full of flavor. Thank you so much to Nanai Watabe, Judith Noël-Gagnon, Annika Walsh, and Maxime Giroux. Go out and find your nearest mushroom monger and reacquaint yourself with the incredible options there are for taste and curiosity. Or if you want to truly feel the mycorrhizal magic, contact a local mushroom forager and step out into the woods yourself. Just remember to always respect the environment, take no more than you need, and follow the advice of experts before you stick anything in your own mouth. Consult the show notes for links to the resources mentioned, and if you haven't done so already, please leave a quick review and rating for the show wherever you listen. It really does help to spread the spores. Next week's episode wraps up season one of Making a Meal of It, and we close things out with, what else? Dessert! More specifically, it's an episode about pudding, from the origins and evolutions of the word to the technical innovations that have made puddings both encased and instant. I talked to a maker of what puddings have become, as well as a food scientist who was once asked to do something nearly unspeakable. I also go back to those food questionnaire questions that were posed to me and consider how preparing and eating pudding really might make a meal of things. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, Nusholsen and Nigma. Mati Hidagan Anda.